Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York and welcome to CFR's National Program Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, the Vice President of the National Program and Outreach. And as a reminder, today's discussion will be on the record. We are pleased to have with us Shannon O'Neill. She is the Douglas Dillon Fellow for Latin America Studies here at CFR and was the director of the CFR-sponsored Independent Task Force on U.S. Latin America Relations. She brings to our conversation today invaluable knowledge of the topic. She has been a Fulbright Scholar to Mexico. She's sought after as a commentator on television and radio programs and publishes a blog, Latin Intelligence. She's currently writing a book that explores the changes that Mexico has undergone in the past two decades and the implications for U.S. foreign policy. Shannon, thank you very much for being with us today. Drug-related violence in Mexico has been a pervasive issue, and we have seen a recent outbreak of violence in the past week or so. Could you give us an overview of what's happening, the nature of the problem, and what you think needs to be done?
Sure. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. We have seen a very difficult start from Mexico to 2010. We saw in January 16 students killed in Ciudad Juarez. They were gunned down at a party that really shook Mexico nationally. In February, we saw violence between two cartels in the border state of Tamaulipas, which borders Texas and the Gulf of Mexico. We saw violence increase substantially as two of the big cartels began to fight amongst themselves. And then, as you mentioned, this last weekend, we saw 50 people killed, actually, over the weekend, but three of them were affiliated with the U.S. consulate in Ciudad Juarez, which, of course, has hit the airwaves and headlines in the United States over this last week, as well as Mexico's, of course. And this first few months of violence really comes in the wake of increasing violence over the last few years. Since Calderon came into office at the end of 2006, we've seen some 18,000 people killed in drug-related violence. So, you know, these levels really rival at least recent levels of violence in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, where people expect more violence than in our southern neighbor. So let me talk a bit about why we're seeing this increase in drug violence over the last couple of years. I mean, first, just to start, we need to remember that supplying of illegal drugs and other illegal goods from Mexico is not something new to the U.S.-Mexico relations. There's always been an illegal business from Prohibition on throughout the 20th century supplying these types of goods. And when you have illegal markets and contracts are disputed, so to speak, you often end up with bloodshed. So there's some history here of this movement of goods back and forth across the U.S.-Mexico border. But we have seen some significant changes, and let me just talk about a few of them. One is the scale of operations. Mexico now is the main pipeline for illegal drugs coming from outside the United States into the United States. So, for instance, in 1990, Mexico, only 50% of the cocaine to the United States came through Mexico. Now it's 90-plus percent. It's also the biggest supplier of marijuana, of heroin, of meth, and other synthetic drugs that come from outside to the United States. So we see a different scale of operations compared to previous years. A second big change is the shift of the base of power of drug-related organized crime from primarily Colombia in the 1980s and 90s to Mexico more recently. So after a few decades of the U.S. war on drugs and billions of dollars spent in interdiction and eradication abroad, one outcome has been to move the epicenter of power over these criminal networks from South America to our border. And that, in turn, leads to more violence as the stakes are much higher between the various groups. And the third longer-term factor to consider here is actually, ironically, Mexico's democratization. Mexico became a full-fledged democracy in 2000 when we saw an alternation of power in the executive office and the president. And with the end of the political monopoly of the old political party, the PRI, this has undermined many understandings that have been there between high-level PRI officials and drug traffickers. So when you upset the market and the way it's working, we see uncertainty and bloodshed. Another aspect of democratization that affected violence was a shift in power from the central government to the states. Mexico had always been a federal system, much like our own, but de facto power was centralized in the president's office under the old authoritarian system. Once the rules actually came in force that it was a federal system, more powers moved to the states, and states, while they have various levels of capacity, overall have been less capable of dealing with the violence and corruption that drug trafficking has brought. And then finally, democracy also brought what it brings sometimes in our own country, which is legislative gridlock. And so for over the last 10 years, it's been quite difficult for democratic governments to pass police reforms, judicial reforms, other reforms that are important in this fight against the drug traffickers. So let me turn a bit to talk about what the Mexican and U.S. responses have been, particularly over the last 3 years of the Calderon government. And the first main response by Calderon and then supported by the United States has been a military response. So Calderon came out right after he assumed office in December of 2006, focusing on the security situation and drug traffickers and bringing military troops to the streets of Mexico to replace local perceived corrupt police forces and to try to bring basic safety to the streets of Mexico. The United States has supported this effort, and it's been a big part of the Merida Initiative, which was started about 3 years ago, which brings roughly $1.5 billion to Mexico in various types of security systems. Now, this element of the security strategy in Mexico has had some responsiveness, particularly at the beginning. We saw some declines in violence, but over the course of the last 3 years, even though there's some 50,000 troops in the streets of Mexico, organized crime has become accustomed to the way the military works, and particularly to the limitations of this approach. And then we've seen violence, particularly in some states, increase significantly since the beginning of this particular process. A second element of the Mexican and U.S. responses has been to reform the federal police force, so the national police. Now, this has involved restructuring the organization of these police forces and then also increasing their number. So we've seen an increase from about 30,000 to 40,000. We've also seen a change in the way these groups are vetted. There are much more stringent requirements on entering into the federal police, and then also on training. And the training requirements have grown up significantly. And part of this police force, a new investigative police force, actually has a much higher level of education. Most of them have to be college graduates. So it's changing the nature of the police and professionalizing and making it a professional career path for Mexicans. Now, this is something the United States has also worked closely with Mexico on, and here I'd say there's been significant headway over the last 3 years in developing a much more professional police force. But in terms of the violence, the problems here are that this national police force, however professional and clean it may be, only represents about 10% of Mexico's overall police forces. They also deal mostly with national crimes. Drug trafficking is one of them, but national crimes represent only about 5% of total crime in Mexico. So for the average citizen, this doesn't get at local security issues and the usual crimes that they're subjected to. So it still leaves a problem. It leaves violence still on the table. And the final aspect of both the Mexican and U.S. approach has been to focus on technology and intelligence. So we've seen the introduction in Mexico of a big national database to help in investigating crimes. And we've seen more intelligence going back between the United States and Mexico. Now, this has led to some particularly recent successes in taking down some key drug kingpins, which we've seen in the last couple months. But still, the removal of these high-level members of the drug cartel, sometimes the leaders of drug cartels, doesn't necessarily reduce the violence. So we've seen that, in some cases, almost increase as the next level down within these organizations tried to retain control over their territory vis-a-vis other cartels trying to move in. Now, given the significant increase in violence and what we've seen over the last couple of months in particular, we're starting to see a shift in strategy, both on the Mexican side and then on the U.S. support under the Obama administration for Mexico's security policies. And here there's really two main aspects. One is we're starting to see a greater concentration on the local level. You know, decisions have been made that they can't just focus on the federal level, but that in the end, since all security is local, there has to be a focus on local police, local courts, local interactions. And the second element of this shift in strategy we're seeing is a more comprehensive understanding or articulation of the problem and then the solutions for it. So we're seeing a move beyond a primarily military strategy to one that looks at the whole of local government and government in general, particularly local. So addressing issues of corruption, of accountability, of how you might engage the community to get involved in the fight against the traffickers. And, you know, dealing with youth at risk, prevention programs, rehabilitation programs, that sort of thing. Now, I'd argue that this on both the U.S. and the Mexican side is a move in the right direction. But first, this is a very new move on both sides. So the programs are not developed, nor even the overall strategy, I'd argue. And two, it comes at not the most politically opportune moment, particularly in Mexico. Calderon has less than 3 years left of his term as president. He's just gone through a major economic recession, as, of course, we have. So it's reduced his spending capacity on a much broader array of programs. And he's also, last July, lost a significant amount of support in the Congress. So the main party now in the Congress is the opposition pre-party. And so how much change he can create, and particularly if reforms need to be passed, it may be very difficult for him to actually change the strategy. So that's looking forward. The question is, one, will he really be able to change the strategic strategy over the next 3 years? And then finally, will many of the good policies that he's put in place over the last 3 years last when the next government comes in? Mexican governments have a history of when each president comes in after the six-year term of the last president, have a history of taking all the reforms and investment the last president did in particular areas of police reform or court reform, throwing it out and starting all over with a clean slate. And so the investment Mexico and the United States have made over the last 3 years, the question is, will that be continue and be invested in further, or will the next president just start over? So with that, let me open it up to broader questions.
Great. Thank you, Shannon. Let's open it up now for questions and comments.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key, that is star one, on your touch-tone phones now. Questions will be taken in the order which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the queue, press star two. Again, that is star one to ask a question. Our first question is from Greg Trefferton with the RAND Corporation.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm calling in from Sweden. I want to ask not a broader question, but a narrow question. You talk, I think, wisely about the shift. As you look at that shift, are there interesting specific ideas or straws in the wind, things that look to you particularly promising, given the overall very mixed outlook?
You know, a lot of these programs are really yet to leave the drawing board, so it remains really what gets put in place. One thing the U.S. government has been pushing on their side of it and is part of their process is greater evaluation of the situation. And that's something that particularly in some of these border states and towns is lacking. But in general, in Mexico, there are a lot of great social programs out there that have been in place for some period of time. But evaluating what types of programs work and what types of programs don't work and how they work and what sort of measures you can take is really lacking within the Mexican system. So U.S. programs, be it through USAID or other aspects of this general support from Mexico, that can take some of the initiatives that are underway and evaluate really what effect they're having, or as new initiatives are developed along the way in the planning, have some sort of evaluation. So a year from now, 18 months from now, or 3 years from now, what have you, you can actually see what made a difference and what didn't, and then tailor your future programs accordingly. I think that actually will be an important aspect on a very micro level of improving the situation. And it's actually something that the United States is quite good at doing.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Michael Matthews with Westgate Capital.
Shannon, thank you very much for a very informative presentation. I very much appreciate it. One of the things that is obvious is that the demand side of this whole equation is really our responsibility. And I think Secretary of State Clinton expressed that some months ago when she was visiting down there. What do you see? The war on drugs has failed miserably, it appears. What do you see concrete steps might be taken by U.S. at this junction to lessen the demand side of the equation?
Well, we have seen when Secretary Clinton was down in Mexico last April, she famously said that there was a co-responsibility here with the United States and Mexico in the war on drugs, and particularly because we are the largest market in the world for these drugs, and particularly the drugs that come through Mexico.
Right.
Now, what the United States is able or willing to do on the demand side really remains to be seen. There has been some changes, particularly, for instance, Attorney General Eric Holder has said that we're not going to prosecute or go after, you know, those people selling marijuana in the United States, particularly if it's medical marijuana, that this sort of de facto decriminalization in some areas of the United States isn't going to be a strong issue for the federal government. So there's some change happening on the state level within the United States. But at the federal government, I don't yet see a real appetite in taking this issue on. And if you look at the recent sort of drug policy budget that the Obama administration put forth, it's still about the same balance between policies addressing the supply side, i.e. eradication, interdiction, and fighting the war on drugs abroad, and demand side, which is more prevention, rehabilitation, dealing with this more as a medical health issue. We still see an imbalance with much more of the funding going to the supply side, to the much more militarized war on drug sides than the more public policy, health-oriented public policy. We've seen in Congress there's a few people looking, trying to establish a commission to really reevaluate our policy on war on drugs, primarily because they believe exactly what you do, that it's failed over the last four decades. But, you know, as you all know, there's a few things on President Obama's agenda at this moment, and I don't see him or the Democrats wanting to take on the drug issue and spend any political capital on this at this point, which, unfortunately, for what Mexico or other countries are facing, means a bit of more of the same, even though we may see, for instance, in the Merida Initiative or what comes after the Merida Initiative, we are seeing and will see a change from a more military-focused, equipment-based funding to things that are a bit more soft or you know, institutional-focused, so more on training and capacity building and reforming of court systems, police systems, other things. I think we will see more money go to that, but within the United States and our issue with demand reduction, I don't see a huge change in policy.
Thank you.
Shannon, do you think that will make a difference on the ground, expanding the joint intelligence units and additional training for Mexican police, prosecutors, and judges?
In the only way Mexico can reduce its violence problem and its problem with organized crime, I would argue in the long term, is assuming that drugs continue, and even if drugs didn't continue, Mexico still is going to have an organized crime problem. The only way it can deal with it is to strengthen its institutions that fight organized crime. And if there's actually any lessons from the United States to be garnered here, is that, you know, we in the middle of the last century had a significant organized crime problem ourselves, with the likes of Al Capone and other, you know, Hollywoodized characters. And we worked very hard for several decades to improve our own police forces, our court systems, to take on organized crime. And Mexico is a different situation. The path will be different, but strengthening of those institutions is the only way you come up with a long-term sustainable solution. Otherwise, if that doesn't happen, we'll be in the exact same place 10 years from now, after both countries spending billions of dollars searching out particular kingpins. Their names will be different, but those people will still be there. So I do actually think this shift to institution building, as messy as it is and how hard it is to do, that is the direction both Mexico and the United States need to go to actually change the situation.
Great. And you have argued that the corruption that we see today is very different from the past. Can you talk a little bit about that, the change in the military vis-a-vis the political system?
Sure. Mexico, as most of you probably know, was ruled for nearly 70 years by one political party called the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or the PRI, as by its acronym. And during the time of this rule, which ended just in the year 2000, so really a short amount of time ago, the police forces, law enforcement forces, but particularly the judicial branch, the court systems, were not designed really, or were not used in the way you think of those types of systems actually working. They were used more as a wing of the political party. So they were used as carrots and sticks. So if you were a supporter of the PRI and you crossed the line of the law, you did something that you shouldn't have done, often you would get away with it. If you were an opponent of the PRI, even if you'd done nothing wrong, there were a good chance that you would actually be punished or the threat of punishment, either through the law enforcement or the court system. So come democratization just 10 years ago, all of a sudden Mexico is dealing with trying to change these systems and the usual ways of things working under an authoritarian regime and create a functioning court and law enforcement system quite different from what it had for a long time. At the same time, both of these systems are facing a huge influx of billions of dollars from drug cartels trying to manipulate these particular state institutions for their own means. So this is no small task that the democratizers, the reformers in Mexico or others have in front of them. But it's a different type of corruption. Earlier on, it was much more of a political monopoly than working with drug traffickers, often choosing one drug trafficker to work with and keeping that particular person's rivals away. Once you open up and you have more political competition, it's brought economic competition, frankly, in the illegal markets because there's more politicians to negotiate with, there's more police captains or other judges to negotiate with, and each time there's a change in government, in the political government because of elections, there's new people to negotiate with. So that's part of the increase in violence is because when negotiations happen in these types of markets, it often leads to bloodshed or at least threats of bloodshed. And we're seeing that happen much more often because of alternations in political power.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Nancy Jarvis with Farrand Cooper.
Good afternoon, Shannon. It's my understanding that in the last few months, Finance Minister Carstens has been moved into a new position and someone else is now Finance Minister. Can you explain what happened and why and whether you view this positively or negatively?
Sure. So we saw in December Carstens move to become the head of the central bank and a long-term PAN supporter and technocrat within the PAN, a man named Ernesto Cordero, come in as the new finance minister. Carstens was moved primarily because he had, I think in the beginning, actually wanted the position at the central bank. So it was something that he was quite interested in down the road, assuming that position. There were also long historical grievances between President Felipe Calderon and the previous head of the central bank based on politics and things that had occurred in the 1990s. So Calderon wasn't particularly keen on keeping Guillermo Ortiz as the head of the central bank when his term came up last year. So that was one reason. And then two, Cordero, the new Secretary of the Treasury, has a very close relationship with Calderon. And so I do think Calderon had always been looking for a key position to put Cordero in. Calderon has put many people very close to him, loyalists, in positions of power, and Ernesto Cordero is no exception in that case. Now, what this means for Mexico? Well, Carstens continues to be there, and he, by all accounts, in his background and training and his strong ties with the international financial community, will do quite well as the head of the central bank. And that's an important role for Mexico's stability and economic growth, as we all know. Ernesto Cordero is less known. He has not spent a lot of time on the international financial policy circuit. He hasn't been part of the IMF or World Bank or other places as Carstens or others have been. So he's still finding his place, at least on the international side. On the domestic side, it remains to be seen. I mean, he has very strong support of the president. He knows all the other cabinet ministers quite well. He made the decision to keep all of the undersecretaries basically in place, so it's not as if we've seen a huge overhaul within the Treasury Department that might lead to, you know, policy instability or miscommunication. So there is a good amount of continuity continuing, which I think is good for Mexico. But the question with him will still remain, is he able to push through and push the Calderon agenda effectively? He just released this last week changes to the fiscal budget, some cuts in various areas to, you know, limit Mexico's deficit over the next year. And so over the next couple months, we'll see whether or not he can effectively push this agenda with Congress controlled by opposition parties.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now.
Shannon, are there parts, locales in Mexico that are doing better than others, and that you could point to areas, cities that are having a better success?
One thing particularly concerning the security situation in Mexico is that while the numbers are incredibly high of the deaths that we've seen, the violence is very centralized. And about half of the deaths are occurring in just 3 particular states in Mexico, many of them within cities within those particular states. So this isn't a widespread phenomenon that, you know, if you were walking in the streets of Ciudad Juarez, which has been the most violent city within Mexico, you have a reason to be quite worried that you might get caught in the crossfire or just that there's serious problems there. But many other places within Mexico have really seen no increase in violence. And what's interesting, actually, is the overall homicide rate, not connected to drug trafficking, but overall homicide rate in Mexico has been falling fairly consistently for the last few decades. So Mexico overall is much safer than it was in the 1980s or early 1990s, though in particularly cities along the border or in these areas where we see conflict between different drug trafficking organizations, the levels of violence have increased exponentially.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Anne Morse with the National Conference of State Legislatures.
Hi. Thanks very much for the presentation. It's been fascinating. I know primarily your research is national level, but I'm wondering if you have any comments or about border state issues and collaboration since it's gone from centralized Mexico to local. Is there increases? Are there good examples to point to?
You know, one thing we're seeing in both the U.S. national strategy, sort of what comes after Merida Initiative, is a focus on more local-level issues. And it looks as if the U.S. government, working with the Mexican federal government as well as local governments, is going to focus on 2 particular areas, pilot programs, one in Tijuana and one in Ciudad Juarez. And that will involve working with local police, working with local court systems, working with local community organizations, really a whole comprehensive group of security and economic and social policies to try to and in these cities. The feeling is that, you know, Juarez is sort of the worst right now in Mexico and has the biggest challenges to face. Tijuana has been in that position before but seems to be on an upward improving situation, and perhaps the United States helping the Mexican governments local and higher level to keep that momentum going in the right direction. So we're seeing that. You know, there have been, as I'm sure most of you know, longstanding relationships between U.S. cities and counties and states and their Mexican counterparts right over the border. And so there are a lot of interchanges that go on built on years of personal relationships and trust that have developed, and so those sorts of things will continue. And it looks as if the U.S. federal government is becoming more interested in these lower-level interactions and providing some funding for those interchanges to continue. So we've seen in the Department of Homeland Security, we've seen more interest in this and funding going to through the Southwest Border Initiative and other measures going to trying to support some of these more homegrown local initiatives. But some of this and the back and forth, particularly those funded by the national governments or the interest of the national governments, are really just at the beginning, planning, and incipient phases.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Richard Sinkin with Inter-American Holdings.
Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Richard.
A quick question about another part of the supply chain here, which is cash and arms from the U.S. to Mexico. Could you, aren't there things that the U.S. could do that wouldn't involve a major political move like sort of decriminalizing the demand side that could be very helpful to Mexico right now?
These are the two main issues for the Mexican government with the United States, because they understand that we have difficulties dealing with the demand side. Of course, they'd like for us to do that, but their initiatives and what they would like us to do focus on these two main issues. And frankly, this is the basis of the business and the violent side of the drug business. So in terms of cash, we see billions and billions of dollars go back every year from the United States, from retail consumers and their wholesale suppliers back across the U.S.-Mexico border. And we also see the vast number of the guns and the guns that are used in the violence down there are coming from the United States. So when they're traced back through e-trace and other systems, it's upwards of 90% of the guns are coming from the United States. Now, we all know that with our Second Amendment and with the NRA and other lobbies, it's very hard to change our gun laws or, for instance, put on an assault ban weapon, laws or things like that. But there are things we can do within the laws that currently stand. On the gun side of things, it's illegal to, currently under U.S. law, it's illegal to sell guns to straw buyers, i.e. those who aren't going to keep them and those that aren't buying them for their own personal use. It's illegal to sell to foreign nationals. And it's also illegal to transport guns across international boundaries, i.e. across the U.S.-Mexico border, without a permit. And with the thousands of guns that end up in the hands of the cartels, at least one, if not all of these rules are being broken. And so that's something with greater enforcement through the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, as well as other agencies, we could enforce our laws more strongly. On the other side, the cash side, which is as important as the guns, perhaps more because, you know, cash buys the guns and it buys people in Mexico and the United States and it runs this business. It's the reason for being in this business in the first place. We could do a better job of stopping the flows of cash into Mexico. Some of this money goes through financial channels. With the Patriot Act and others, we've become a bit more vigilant on the money that goes through these different types of channels. But if any of you have been following the news recently with Vacovia, where it has been sending billions of dollars to exchange houses along the border, it looks like through lax watching of its rules, it has been basically laundering money into Mexico over the last several years. So there's more stringent requirements on that side. But we also see billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars, put in the back of cars and trucks and other vehicles and just driven back south across the border. So for both the cash and the guns, checking what goes south as much as we check things going north would be quite helpful to the Mexican government.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your telephone touchpad. Our next question is from Robert Newman, the Virginia Office of Adjudicators.
Dr. O'Neill, do you see any connections between the criminal aspects of drug trafficking across the border and international terrorism?
You know, so far, there have been little to no evidence of ties between the criminal drug trafficking and terrorists. I mean, the thought of many who study this is that, you know, the criminal drug traffickers have such a good business going and make so much money. Why would they want to mess it up by bringing across a terrorist, which would then lead to a shutting down, basically, of the U.S.-Mexico border the way we saw back after September 11th. Now, that said, these two things. One, these criminal drug trafficking networks and organizations are no longer just drug trafficking organizations. They really become multinational conglomerates that do a whole host of different types of things. They extort businesses, they kidnap people, and they've gotten increasingly into human smuggling, bringing up illegal immigrants and others into the United States. And so in this last element, the idea of smuggling, you could see how they smuggle often, you know, just Mexicans that want to come to the United States and work for, you know, find jobs and have money to send back to their families. But they also often bring up what they're called other than Mexicans, OTMs. And it's possible, though there's been no evidence that's happened so far, that they would bring someone up that had other intentions in mind than rather working in a restaurant in New York City. That's one thing. The second element is that in part because of the pressure of the U.S. government and the Mexican government on these drug cartels and the capture of several key kingpins or the heads of some of these cartels, we've seen a fragmentation of the organization. So it's a little bit of a – it's a little bit misleading to talk about, oh, there's five or six big cartels in Mexico. Because, yes, there are, but there are a lot of smaller organizations that are affiliated with these cartels. And there's a lot of people that, frankly, work as freelancers. And one day they're working for the Juarez cartel as a hitman, and then the next day they're on their own or working with some other sort of local gang. And here, broadly speaking, these people may not be thinking as long-term or strategically in a business sense. And if they see money on the table, they might be more willing to help smuggle someone over the border or something else. So the short answer to your question is no, we have not seen ties between these criminal drug trafficking networks and terrorists, really. But the longer answer is that it's not out of the realm of possibility that perhaps that could happen. It's something the United States should keep watching for, but I wouldn't make it our main concern.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Any final questions?
No, ma'am. I'm showing no more questions.
Shannon, you've done a great job giving us a comprehensive overview. Is there anything that we haven't covered?
I mean, I think the main challenge, besides the issues that are on the table, but the main challenge Mexico faces, which means inherently the United States faces, is how do you create a sustainable security policy in Mexico? And while we can argue about it should be a little bit more of this or a little bit more of that, in general, I believe the Mexican government's moving in the right direction, as well as the U.S. government supporting it. But the big question comes, Mexico will have presidential elections in 2012. We will have a new president come in, and whatever party that president's from, often what's happened in the past, as I mentioned, is they start from zero. They decide to totally reform the police force or totally reform the judicial system or totally reform all these different areas, throwing out a lot of the good of the past administration as well as some of the problems in the way that the last administration had structured things. And this has happened not just when administrations switch parties, but even when administrations have the same party. So it's not just an issue between the differences between party approaches. And so for the United States, one, we should be supporting Mexico because it's in our own self-interest. But two, we should be thinking about how to help ensure the continuity and that the gains of these last three and when the elections come up, the last 6 years, will be built on rather than torn down again.
Great. Thank you very much for the terrific overview, and to everybody else for being on the call. We appreciate it. We will be sending out an invitation for the next teleconference in the coming days, so please keep an eye out for that. But Shannon, thank you again, and I encourage you all to take a look at Shannon's blog, Latintelligence. And Shannon, what is the URL about again?
It's Latintelligence, so Latin. And I can't even spell right now.
Elligence.com.
Thank you.
There we go. So I encourage you all to go there and take a look at it because Shannon is commenting on these issues in Mexico and in Latin America more broadly. So please take a look. So thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.